Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with two important new and revealing studies assessing the first year of the Trump administration. The first, Trump's national security and foreign policy failures, year one. And the second, what internet search data reveal about Donald Trump's first year in office. Daniel Ben-Aim, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as a Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate, joins us to discuss his report on the first year of Trump's abysmal foreign policy record, which has left America more isolated and less respected, and the extraordinary speech in the Senate today by Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who likened Trump to Joseph Stalin and other despots, warning, quote, "The president has it precisely backwards. Despotism is the enemy of the people. The free press is the despot's enemy, which makes the free press the guardian of democracy." And in terms of Trump's lasting damage to our foreign policy, quote, "Mr. President, so powerful is the presidency that the damage done by the sustained attack on the truth will not be confined to the president's time in office." Then we will speak with Darrell West, the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and the Founding Director of the Center for Technological Innovation. He's the author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust, and the author of a new report, What Internet Search Data Reveal About Donald Trump's First Year in Office, which finds that over the year, the public's interest in Trump has dropped dramatically, while interest in his impeachment has spiked. Then finally, we'll examine the arrest of an ex-CIA officer charged with spying on China, who was suspected of exposing the CIA's spy network in China, causing the murder or capture of around 20 undercover U.S. agents. June Dreyer, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in Chinese government and foreign policy, who was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations, joins us to discuss the pervasive nature of China's spying activity in the U.S. and the tensions between the CIA and FBI counterintelligence over their mole hunt inside the CIA. And joining us now, Daniel Ben-Aim, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, researching U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, as well as a visiting lecturer at New York University. And previously, he served as the Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate. And he has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's National Security and Foreign Policy Failures, Year One. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Ben-Aim.
Thank you for having me.
And the report that you come up with is quite damning, but not entirely surprising. I mean, when you think about the way that the world, and I imagine by extension world leaders, and I'm talking about longstanding allies like the UK, where Trump is not even able to come and visit, let alone attend a royal wedding. But the front page of the German equivalent of Time magazine, Der Spiegel, showing the famous evolution from ape to man, reversing it with ending up with Donald Trump as this sort of de-evolution of mankind, is pretty stinging. But I take it that the real issue here is that the damage done so far, and we're only talking about 1 year, is going to be lasting. And presumably it's going to take a long time and a lot of effort to undo the damage.
You know, that's exactly right. We started this project as we approached a year because we realized that so many of us are so deeply wrapped up in the daily back and forth over each of these issues, each of these outrages, each of these gaffes, that we wanted to try to step back and kind of survey the landscape and ask what's really happened. Where are we after 1 year? And I think you're exactly right. It's already early enough that we know that some of the damage that President Trump has done will outlast him. And there, we know already that there's going to be a significant cleanup ahead in terms of restoring America's moral standing in the world and in terms of shaping up our institutions at home and in terms of trying to rebuild some kind of a consensus inside the country as to what our foreign policy should do, each of which Trump has in its own way kind of come in and shattered. So we stepped back and we started asking ourselves, well, what does this all mean? What does this all add up to? And we came to a few big conclusions. The first is a sort of wholesale abdication of U.S. leadership across the board. We knew we had a window of time now in these years when America was still on top before we had to deal with a growing China to try to set the rules of the world order. And it seems like Trump seems determined to squander that and instead to sort of prematurely withdraw. You could see that in the Paris climate talks and pulling out of UNESCO, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in the global migration talks. There's a big game out there to set these rules, and Trump has just really sidelined the country. And when you think about things like $13 trillion in clean energy investments that the countries in the Paris Accords are going to make in the next 10 years, the idea that we're yelling about coal instead of rushing to grab these opportunities with both hands is just, it's a tremendous surrender of leadership. You know, and then looking inside the country, we just saw the damaging of institutions, the politicizing of the military, the militarizing of the State Department, and the kind of trampling of the norms and institutions against enriching yourself in the job, which kind of goes hand in hand with this sort of moral abdication on the world stage, the praising of dictators, the surrendering of this great signal achievement of the United States, of this idea that there are universal human rights out there that countries need to respect and pay attention to. That didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen by accident. It happened because American presidents of both parties sustained it. Even where we fell short, we held to that principle. That seems to be giving way under Trump, and it's very concerning. And then, of course, they're the key big files, the most explosive and challenging issues we've got. North Korea, where Trump seems to be determined to make it worse one tweet at a time and isn't giving his secretaries of state and defense enough space to try to avoid this nuclear standoff where really nobody wins. Russia, which where Trump seems determined to pull punches and not adequately defend America's democracy from the kind of assault it faced in information warfare back in 2016. Even Jeff Sessions was asked if we're doing enough. He said, well, probably not. And that shrug of the shoulders and that refusal to criticize Putin is really something. And then in the Middle East, you see what I call the silent surge, which is basically the escalation of every single military conflict we've got, combined with basically a resolve to destroy the Iran deal without really having any sense of why or what should come in its place. So you take it all together, and it's quite a lot of shattered China and quite a lot of broken crockery. And as someone who served in the last administration and hopes to have a chance to serve again in another administration that I admire, there's going to be a lot of cleanup to do, and we'll be lucky to get back to right where we started.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Ben-Aim, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he researches U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, as well as a visiting lecturer at New York University. And previously, he served as a Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate. And he has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's National Security and Foreign Policy Failures, Year One. And of course, hanging over this administration is the very legitimacy of the way Trump was elected and the extent to which the Putin and the Russians had a hand in it, and that's being investigated by the special counsel. If you take the extreme version is that Trump could be the Manchurian candidate, obviously that might explain his foreign policy, although that seems far-fetched. But if you take a more realistic assessment, if Putin simply wanted to weaken America and didn't think Trump would necessarily win, but he would weaken Hillary Clinton by running around the country for 4 years saying, lock her up, lock her up. The point is that whatever way it worked out for Putin, whether it was Hillary or Trump, and he helped, obviously got lucky with Trump, the point is that what's happening is America is being weakened. And that, I think, is unassailably Putin's motive.
Yeah, I think you're right. In some way, Putin is like the dog that caught the fire truck. I think he never in his wildest dreams expected that this sort of very low investment in information warfare and hacking, weaponized hacking, would have such a fateful impact. I think he probably knew that he had a pretty good mark in Trump. Mostly, I think, even though these guys seemed eager to take Russia's help, I don't think they considered themselves to be working on Russia's behalf. They just seemed eager to take help from wherever they could, as best we can tell so far. But I think you're right. What Putin wanted to do was basically sow dissension in the U.S. system and weaken the likely next president, Hillary Clinton. And they found themselves smack in the middle of this. Of this presidency in a way that they didn't expect, and with a level of exposure on these relatively small intelligence activities that I think has to have shocked even them. But the truth is that none of this would even be possible if the United States weren't so divided that people wouldn't disqualify Trump for taking this kind of help. He was running out there on the campaign hustings saying, "I love WikiLeaks," and, you know, "Putin's a killer, but we have killers," and all these kinds of things. And if our politics weren't so tribal and divided to begin with, people would have said, "Well, that's outrageous. That's outrageous. You're clearly not fit for this job." But instead, Trump seemed so good at sticking it to people like me and you that that it really appealed to the rest of the country. So we got a lot of work to do, and frankly, some pretty deep questions to ask about how to heal these divides so we can be strong enough to resist this kind of interference going forward.
Sure, and the ultimate divide is there is no consensus about what is real and what is true in this country, and you've got 30 to 35% of the country believing Trump's lies and thinking that the mainstream media is fake news, and this 35% living inside the Fox News bubble are immune to evidence and facts. And
it's a very scary thing. Yeah, I've seen that around the world in my travels in places like Egypt and Iraq. You see what happens with official lying.
Exactly.
People stop believing the government. They start believing the conspiracy theories. And this idea, it may be in some ways the single greatest casualty of this whole presidency, is this idea of a common truth, this idea that we can all look out and see one America and work to advance its interests together. That's, to be honest, of all of the pieces, that's going to be one of the ones that's the hardest to put back together again in the wake of this man and his presidency. Even if he's fully repudiated at some point by the people and by the courts, it's hard to imagine that that bubble really bursts. But those of us who are invested in the outcome are going to have to find a way to try to get to those people as well and create a more united united public. Because when I looked at all the ways in which Trump was weakening America, I think it was that sense of bitter, bitter division that basically politics is about pitting some Americans against others, which is the way that Trump practices politics, as opposed to trying to be everyone's president, that is probably the biggest outcome in terms of weakening the country and the world, even more than the things he's actually done in the world. Because if we're not strong and we're not united to face these challenges together, then other people are going to be able to divide and rule. And you know, pit us against each other as Russia did so effectively.
Well, let's say, if you don't mind, go to a clip of Senator Jeff Flake, the Republican senator who gave a very, very powerful speech today before the U.S. Senate. And he actually talked about the lasting damage to our foreign policy. Just quoting him, "Mr. President, so powerful is the presidency that the damage done by the sustained attack on the truth will not be confined to the president's time in office." Let's go to Senator Jeff Flake today, and then we'll resume the conversation.
It was a year in which an unrelenting daily assault on the constitutionally protected free speech was launched by the same White House, an assault that is as unprecedented as it is unwarranted. "The enemy of the people" was how the President of the United States called the free press in 2017. Mr. President, it is a testament to the condition of our democracy that our own president uses words infamously spoken by Joseph Stalin to describe his enemies. It bears noting that so fraught with malice was the phrase "enemy of the people" that even Nikita Khrushchev forbade its use, telling the Soviet Communist Party that the phrase had been introduced by Stalin for the purpose of, quote, "annihilating such individuals," unquote, who disagreed with the supreme leader. This alone should be the source of great shame for us in this body, especially for those of us in the president's party, for they are shameful, repulsive statements. And of course, the president has it precisely backward. Despotism is the enemy of the people. The free press is the despot's enemy, which makes the free press the guardian of democracy. When a figure in power reflexively calls any press that doesn't suit him fake news, it is that person who should be the figure of suspicion, not the press.
And that was Republican Senator Jeff Flake speaking on the Senate floor today. The idea that you can liken our president to Joseph Stalin in itself is pretty depressing, wouldn't you say, Daniel?
You know, I sure would. I don't know that I would go so far myself to draw that analogy directly, given the things that Stalin did. Trump hasn't done those things. Trump has his own sins to answer for, but they're not the same as Stalin's. And they're not in this, they're orders of magnitude smaller. But the larger question, the idea that someone would be tempted to make that connection, is a reflection of Trump's lack of respect for the 240 years of democratic tradition we have in this country. The idea that he talks about my generals as though he were a kind of military junta chief, I certainly understand. But one of the enduring challenges for all of us in this time is to keep a sense of perspective, you know, because we see these resonances and this authoritarian valence in what he's doing, and we're trying to stop it. But it doesn't mean he is an authoritarian in his actual practices. It doesn't mean he is Stalin or he is a junta leader. It just scares us that he sounds like one. And right. Part of our job as citizens is to really distinguish those differences. So I admire Senator Flake's moral clarity on a lot of these issues. But I'd probably respectfully part ways on the Stalin analogy.
Well, the analogy, of course, being to the enemy of the people and making the press the enemy of the people.
Well, when he quotes Stalin, he certainly does make it easy for people to draw that analogy, let's be clear, yeah.
Well, but I think, in a way, Trump is an authoritarian without the fascist ideology or the Stalinist ideology. I think he's more like a Roman emperor, in fact, which Chris Buckley pointed out in an op-ed in the New York Times.
That was a hilarious piece of writing.
Yeah, but I think an accurate
piece.
I
highly recommend to your listeners.
Yeah. Well, just in closing, then, it is painful and sad to recognize how much work has to be done to undo the damage done so far. But is there any sense that you have that since this man is so unqualified, didn't even expect to get the job, clearly doesn't know what he's doing, is totally out of his depth, governs by distraction and stunt? And the next guest on our program today done a study at the Brookings Institution looking into social media and internet search data from Google, which indicates that the public are tiring of this guy. So is there a quicker way out than having to wait till 2020?
You know, I think my strong guess is that this person, Trump, will serve at least his full term. I suppose it would be theoretically possible that something would go so disastrously wrong, or the Democrats would have sufficient margins in both houses and decide to pursue this kind of strategy. But even if he gets impeached by the House of Representatives, the Senate would need to vote him out of office. I think that this is probably a problem best solved at the polls. My hope is that in come a year from now, he will have a very strong congressional check on his power in the form of a Democratic Senate and Congress, that will block off some pathways that he might use to try to enact damaging parts of his agenda, and that'll give us new tools for oversight. But I think the real key here is to use the institutions that we've got, the democracy that we've got, to try to forge a better path forward, and if things get worse, to look maybe to those other tools. But I think we shouldn't look to be rescued by some provision of the Constitution that's never been invoked. We have to live in the here and now in our democracy and fight on a daily basis for the policies that we believe in, and find ways to mitigate the worst and try to pursue, make good things happen at whatever level of government we can.
Well, Daniel Ben-Ayim, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Ben-Ayim, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, researching U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, as well as a visiting lecturer at New York University. And previously, he served as a Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate. And he has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's National Security and Foreign Policy Failures, Year One.